Jen Cooper, the keeper here, ready for the next episode of the Mix Zone Women's Soccer Podcast, sponsored by Roughneck Scarves. This is podcast number 277. With that number, we'll give a shout out to Canadian keeper Kaylin Sheridan. She has 277 saves in her three seasons in NWSL, all three of them with Sky Blue. She and Aubrey Bledsoe of Washington Spirit share the league record for most saves in one season. That was set in 2018. So shout out to Kaylin Sheridan. And speaking of Canadian Kaylin Sheridan, my first chat today is with Canadian Laura Armstrong, who writes for the Toronto Star. She's also part of the One Soccer broadcast around CONCACAF qualifying. One Soccer is a new channel app website in Canada that's 24 hours a day soccer. We talked about Canada's performance so far in the qualifying tournament, and of course we had to talk about Christine Sinclair. Then I spoke with Stephanie Cleaves, the new executive director of United Women's Soccer, aka UWS, about her role in developing the young Pro-Am League and also her background playing both collegiately in the USA and internationally for Honduras. In between the two chats is my new recurring segment called Jensplaining. Each segment will explain off-the-field rules or take a look at a bit of history to illuminate why things are done a certain way. This week, the topic is, why is the Olympic tournament a little bit different from the World Cup tournament? And hey, don't forget to follow me on Twitter. I've got two feeds that you want to follow. The first is my main soccer feed, which is Keeper Notes. And the second one for this podcast, of course, is Mix Zone. Lots of great updates there, so keep that in mind. All right, Jen Cooper, the keeper here with Laura Armstrong, sports reporter from Toronto Star, which of course means, yeah, Laura's from the Great White North covering the Great White soccer scene. There. Laura, you know, you've got to be part of the broadcast for the Canadian broadcast for the CONCACAF tournament so far. And of course, we're going to talk about, you know, the big world record broken by Christine Sinclair. But first, I want to get your thoughts on the group stage for Canada.
Yeah, I mean, the group stage on Canada's side is kind of similar to the U.S. in that I think that one game sort of stood out above the rest. You didn't really learn anything from St. Kitts and Nevis or Jamaica, but the Canadian team against Mexico, they looked pretty good. They looked organized. They were incisive when they needed to be. You know, they're coming off a poor World Cup. They're coming off a poor end of last season when they played in Asia and lost a couple of games 4-0. You know, so you didn't want to see that. In World Cup, they struggled to score. At the end of the year, they struggled to defend. And you're kind of wondering, like, who's coming in to play here? Like, what team do we have showing up? And certainly they look a lot more like themselves. They look like that dominant force. You know, there's a reason that they keep Canada and the U.S. in different groups in these tournaments. And certainly Canada has shown that they're the dominant force once again. So that's a good thing. There's a lot of positives. I don't think that any games looked particularly hard for Canada, even though the level against Mexico was definitely a lot higher. So I think pretty much all good things for Canada so far.
Yeah, this definitely looked more like the Canada we're used to seeing, especially yeah. Last night versus Mexico. Like you said, it's really hard to gauge how they're playing when you're playing a team like St. Kitts and Nevis. But that match against Mexico, they looked strong, dominant, comfortable, you know, and clicking on all cylinders, all the good cliches that you can throw out there. And it's also been neat to see, I think, you know, some squad rotation, right? Because again, when you've got two somewhat weak teams in your group, you can do that a little bit. But I think it also shows that we're starting to see just a little bit more depth building in this team, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, the squad is down, obviously, from by three players from World Cup, so it's down to 20. So you wonder if the talent's going to be sort of stronger or not as strong, or how you balance that kind of thing. But there's definitely girls that they left out, like Jenna Hallstrom and Lindsay Agnew, who were in the national team system for a long time, and now you're seeing them sort of bumped out. So that's a good thing for Canada. And I mean, there's been so many goal scorers for Canada so far, which is great. I think they made 6 changes between the first game and the second game, and then another 4. So there's always, in Kenneth Heiner-Muller's lineup so far, there's always been sort of those veteran players, people you would expect to be on the field, like a Kadisha Buchanan, Shalina Zdorsky, Steph LeBay, played in net for 2 of the 3 games. But you've seen more of like a Jade Revere, who's still a teenager, Gabby Carl, get more minutes, which I think is really, really important for Canada in this tournament. And I think it's really great the way that Kenneth Heiner-Muller has balanced the squad. I think it was even more rotation than maybe John Herdman would have done. John Herdman mm-hmm. certainly had a different team, a different group that maybe wasn't as strong. But I think that Kenneth Heiner-Muller has really definitely rotated more than I even expected him to. We really haven't seen what I consider to be Canada's best 11 yet. It'll be interesting to see what he does against Costa Rica in the semifinals, because I think that would probably be Canada's best 11 in his mind, those players that he puts on the field. But then again, against the United States, I mean, Canada obviously has a pretty sorry record against the U.S. if they play each other in the final. And it'll be interesting to see like how he manages that group, because at that point, that game's kind of a giveaway. So like maybe you play some different players. I'm not sure. We'll see if he like goes with 2 of the same 11s in the semifinal, and if they make the final, or if he mixes it up again.
Well, one thing, when you're talking about youth, it made me think of this tournament 4 years ago, which was, mm-hmm. you know, following that World Cup in Canada, but it was like kind of the beginning of a new cycle in terms of, I remember Herdman saying that there were a lot of players that he kept on for 2015 because he wanted that maturity, that experience, especially for the pressure of playing a World Cup at home. But mm-hmm. 2016 seemed like he threw the doors open. And I remember there were so many young players playing and qualifying for them in 2016. And of course, these players are still pretty young, right? Like they're still just like 20, sure. 21, 22, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember now that you mentioned like the final, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
The final 2016, like that he did some weird, I think, was it like Matheson maybe? He like brought off the bench late. Like he was trying to see like, hey, if we can hold the U.S. scoreless for 60 minutes and then bring on some starters. And it backfired a little bit. But I like that he was willing to like take a risk with that, right? Because they'd already qualified for the Olympics. So, mm-hmm. you know, you can take a risk in that game.
Yeah, for sure. It's funny, like when you think about it, like Janine Becky didn't make the Canadian women's team in 2015. She wasn't part of that World Cup squad. So 2016, the World Cup or the Olympic qualifiers would have been her first sort of outing with that team. And now you think like she's one of the people that like ostensibly you'd pencil her into the starting 11. So it's definitely grown leaps and bounds. And then you have like a whole new set of players like the Jade Revere's, like Gabby Carls, who are like, you know, the new kids now, whereas like Jesse Fleming and Kadisha Buchanan and Ashley Lawrence would have been, now they're kind of like old hat. And as you said, like Kadisha Buchanan's like 25. She's not old by any stretch of the imagination, but like we're used to them now. So it's wild. This team has definitely grown a lot since you saw them 4 years ago. It's grown, or it's fixed some things since the World Cup. I think they're still sort of navigating some growing pains, but I think that there's definitely been a lot of change and they've weathered it pretty well.
Yeah. And so now, of course, we can talk about the big moment of history last week that I think many of us have been waiting for more than a year, that we thought, you know, could possibly happen during the Women's World Cup last summer. But Sinclair ultimately getting goal number 185 to pass Abby Wambach. So she had two goals in the game against St. Kitts and Nevis to tie and then pass Wambach. So talk about, you know, one, what it was like for you watching that. You were in the studio, I'm assuming, for one soccer, because then you guys had to, you know, talk about it afterwards. And then talk about the coverage that's happened in Canada and the response in Canada.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it like goes back to, in that moment, I kind of thought about the 2002 World Championships, I guess they were called back then, in Edmonton, when,
the
you know,
U19
you got...
tournament. Yeah.
Yeah, the U19 tournament. And I, you know, that was for me, I would have been like 12 probably. And that for me was like really one of my first experiences seeing women's soccer appreciated, because there were like 50,000 people out to watch the final between Canada and the U.S. And I followed the tournament all the way through. And I just, for me, it was really sort of a, not so much a full circle moment, but definitely a moment of like, look how far we've come, and look how far we've come with Christine Sinclair leading the pack, and she's been leading the pack for so long. And so it was really, really nice to see. For me, it was also very nice to see her enjoy the moment as a member of the media who has asked her a million times what she thinks about this record. I was very, very glad that it was done for her, because she really wanted to stop answering those questions. But like in the moment, you could see she got emotional. She participated in a celebration, which is like so unlike her. It was pretty nice to see that. And you know, the U.S. soccer system is still ahead of the Canadian soccer system, right? We're not in Canada. We're not like hard done by any stretch of the imagination, but the quality of the player that Christine Sinclair had around her, particularly in the early days, is not the quality of player that Abby Wambach had around her during the course of her career. So I really think that for a woman who like ostensibly carried this team on her back for a lot of time, nobody deserves it more, you know? And I mean, Abby Wambach's response to it was class. So that was fantastic. Like, I love to see sort of the respect between the players.
Yeah.
But it really was a meaningful moment. And I think that was reflected in the coverage in Canada. I know that the St. Kitts and Nevis coach said before the game that she had wished that it would have happened on Canadian soil. And I wish that it would have happened on Canadian soil too. I think that there would have been more coverage had it happened like at home. But I do think that, you know, Christine Sinclair is synonymous with soccer in this country. Anytime she does something, it garners news, which is not always the case with women's sport in general, but also women's soccer. So I think that, you know, a lot of people had been waiting for this moment to happen, and to see it happen finally, we really have been waiting for about a year for this to happen. It meant a lot to people, particularly in the soccer world, but it also touched sort of everybody. She's an icon up there with like Wayne Gretzky, Hayley Wickenheiser. She's a Canadian icon, and that never really was in doubt before she got the record, but it's certainly not in doubt now.
Yeah, well, and I loved that celebration. you obviously it was planned, and it took a moment to set up, but it was cute, and it also kind of, you know, related to that. It's over. Like, you know, you're bowling the pins over, but it's also like, it's
so un-Canadian too.
It's
like
done.
Canadians don't like to like draw attention to themselves so much. We're normally like, sorry, we broke that record.
Yeah.
And you know, so it was like a nice moment to acknowledge it. Sorry.
Well,
sorry, we have the title now. Cool.
And I'm glad that you brought it up, because I would have brought it up too, that you do have to look at, you know, Sinclair was not surrounded, you know, over the course of her career with other best players in the world, right?
No.
Because I think that's a much better way of looking at it than a lot of people say. It's like, oh, well, you know, but she plays CONCACAF a lot, or Abby played a lot of weak teams, or, you know, Mia Hamm's record is from when they played a lot of weak teams. I'm like, I don't think that's a good way to break it down. I did, of course, on my website under my WOSO nerd link section, I do have a chart that shows all of Abby's, all of Mia's, all of Sinclair's, and it even lists like who they're playing against and what tournament was in. And when you break it down, it's fairly even in terms of, you know, Olympics, World Cup, CONCACAF qualify, you know, like, so it's
sure.
Yeah. Like that's not a breakdown. That's why I think it's more impressive to me with Sinclair's that it's yeah. from a country where you haven't had the best support long-term for women's soccer.
No, for sure.
You know, yeah, exactly. it's like, you know, the last several years, yeah, but historically overall, you know, no. And one of the things that I looked up after it happened, because I was kind of curious, because also Sinclair is approaching 300 caps, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's only two people who have over 300 caps. And of course, they're both American women, Christy Rampone, mm-hmm. Christine Lilly. Sinclair's at 291, Carly Lloyd mm-hmm. at 290. Sink could get there first. It'll probably be pretty close. But one thing I was curious about was how many, you know, who has the most minutes of those people with the most caps? So I looked it up for the people with like the, you know, maybe the top six with caps.
Mm-hmm.
This really stuck out to me. Christy Rampone finished with 311 caps. Mm-hmm. Sink is at 291 right now. That's 20 games apart. Sinclair has already played many more minutes than Rampone
yeah.
did, because from the beginning of her career, she was basically a starter, because you didn't have the depth, you know, and wealth of talent. So it's not like she at 16, she was slowly being, you know, groomed into the team, right? No, she was,
yeah,
she was
no.
starting from the get go. So she, you know, she would have to play another 50 games or so to catch up with Christine Lilly's minutes. But mm-hmm. bottom line, only one person in the world has played more minutes of international soccer than Christine Sinclair.
Who was that?
Well, you know, and that's Lilly.
Okay.
Christine Lilly. Because okay. Lilly retired with right. 354 caps. And
okay.
and she did start a lot. So it's like,
yeah,
that when I looked up that number, that just really struck me. It's like,
yeah,
because we've seen players, male, female, all different countries, like at the beginning of their career, maybe at the end of the career, where, you know, it's like you're just trying to pick up some caps, like you're not getting a lot of minutes, right?
Yeah.
But it's like Sinclair, it's like she's almost always starting and she's almost always playing the whole game. It's
from the beginning of her career, she's been a star. She hasn't just been a starter, right? Like she's been more than just a
right.
starter. She's been the focal point of that team. And like one of the, I mean, there's so much to just sort of swoon about with Christine Sinclair, but the way that she's handled, like she's really been so lucky with injury. She's such a durable player. Like she goes and she plays in the NWSL, like, and she's a cornerstone of that team for a long time too. And you know, then she comes back to Canada and she's shouldering so much weight, and she's doing it, you know, just at an incredible rate. And then there's I mean, lots of people have said great things about Christine Sinclair in the last week or so, and lots of people have said great things about her before, but she's just one of the best athletes of our time, not just soccer players.
Yeah. So I was pleased to see that. You know, I'm sure many people were, obviously. And like you said, mm-hmm. Abby Wambach's response was class. And it's also this kind of thing. It's like, cool, now we can move on. You know,
that's
like,
exactly it. Nobody is happier about that than Christine Sinclair herself, let me tell you.
I just wish it could have been done like at a stadium with more people, but I'm sure they'll have a big celebration for it when they have the friendly in Vancouver in April.
Definitely.
So looking ahead, let's mm-hmm. look ahead to this weekend. We've got the semifinals. So Canada will play Costa Rica, US against Mexico. Winners meet in the final, but of course, really the only important games are the semifinal. You win your semifinal, mm-hmm. you've qualified for the Olympics. You don't win, you don't. There is no playoff spot. It's just, you know, You got to win the semifinal. There's only two CONCACAF teams that go to the Olympics, because Olympics is only 12 teams, not 24 like the World Cup. So what are your thoughts for Canada, you know, facing Costa Rica? You know, what do you think Kenneth Heiner-Muller is going to do?
I mean, I think my thoughts are similar for Canada and for the U.S. is just that it's like when at all costs, and they should be expected to win. Like both of these teams should be expected to be in the final, as they probably should have been since the beginning of of the tournament. I think that he's done a lot of rotation in his squad, and I think that you'll probably see something close to his best 11. Maybe not his best 11. Maybe there will be some people who are like sort of in form. Like Nichelle Prince looked good in the game against Mexico, but you know, coming off of injury, I don't know that she's at her best necessarily. Although she probably deserves to be on the field based on her performance in the World Cup when half of Canada's team barely showed up, and she really carried a lot of weight in that tournament. So I think that it'll be kind of similar to the Mexico game. I think that Canada will just look to sort of control the game. I'm sure that Costa Rica, who is, you know, Costa Rica and Canada have met so many times, and they've always sort of been right there with Canada and the U.S. as like the possible threat, but never really sort of making good on that. And so I think that they'll have to manage probably a lot of pressure early, and then ideally, you know, just sort of control the rhythm, control the tempo. And I think that the Mexico game was really good for that. And in terms of the U.S., like, I don't see the Mexicans threatening the U.S. at all. I think that the game against Canada was probably really tiresome. I also don't love this travel in the middle of a tournament, particularly when the tournament's not very long. So I think everybody's going to be a little bit tired going forward, but the Mexican team just doesn't have a lot of depth. So I presume that they'll go with a lot of the same 11 that they went with against Canada, and they really killed themselves trying to sort of keep pace. And so I think that the U.S. will probably face a pretty tired team on Friday.
Yeah, I was wondering what, you know, Mexico was going to do, if they would do something similar to Costa Rica facing the U.S. They basically rested their two best players, right? Mm-hmm. They said we're not going to, you know, winning the group means little. We need these players. We want our best shot at qualifying for the Olympics. And I wondered if Mexico might do something similar, though I think they're still very much in a rebuilding phase. Not that they don't have a lot of talent. I guess I shouldn't say rebuilding. Well, we'll say transitional, because the team we saw from Mexico at the 2018 CONCACAF tournament was their older team, a team where like almost none of their starters were players coming out of Liga MX. This squad is now many more players coming out of the relatively new Liga MX league, incorporating more of the players from their 2018 U20 squad. So it's, you're kind of seeing that transition, I guess, you know, the baton is being passed from one squad to the next with a little overlap. So I'm really intrigued to see how that match goes down. I don't really see an upset on either side, right? Like,
no.
If Canada had faltered at all against Mexico, I'd be like, uh-oh. But now they looked clean. You know, I do think it's weird, like you said, you know, this much travel in a short tournament. I thought it interesting that, so Canada and Mexico have one less day of rest. Mm-hmm. And Canada has to play the earlier game Friday. Yeah. Now, I get, obviously, you know, the tournament's in the U.S. Yeah, you're going to put the U.S. in the, you know, in the later prime time spot. But it's still, you know, to me, this is still just the problem with doing these tournaments, is that it hurts the game, right? Like,
yeah, for sure.
And also, like, you know, like Houston hosting three double headers in a week, you know, the Rio Grande Valley of Texas hosting three double headers in the week. It means that you're, you know, not going to have a lot of attendance, right? Because like most people cannot afford or have the time to go to all three, right? So people are going to pick and choose, you know. It's like, now I get the challenge too of like, well, hey, if you're traveling to venue, like, well, that's expensive and that's tiring. But it just speaks to the whole, like, pushing qualifying into a little 2-week tournament just is a challenge.
For sure.
But that's a whole different discussion. But let's talk, let's kind of wrap up our chat with just, you know, other kind of Canadian soccer topics. Like, you're now, you know, working for, at least for this tournament, a new channel, or rather a new broadcaster for soccer in Canada. And I've been watching on the app and I've been loving it.
Yeah, I mean, I really haven't. I you know, have some.
So tell me how that got started.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the origin story so much of it. I mean, they came in along with the Canadian Premier League, which is our new sort of league across the country, men's league, that is sort of focused on developing players and making sure that players have somewhere to go after they like maybe are 16 and they're looking for clubs and they're looking to sort of develop more players to maybe lead to the MLS, maybe lead to going to Europe, that kind of thing. That's my understanding of the league, at least. And then, you know, ideally develop the league to the point where it's a Premier League, it's the best, you know, league in the country, best quality of soccer. So One Soccer is like an all soccer channel. It's online, kind of like DAZN at this point, and it's a subscription based channel. And so far, you know, it's a really professional channel. And I think that, you know, something that is happening, at least in media in Canada, is that there's a lot of layoffs and a lot of job loss because media is struggling. And one really great thing, one really disappointing thing is that, you know, soccer tends to be one of the first sports to get hit because, and soccer reporters, just because, you know, it's not as big as hockey or baseball or basketball necessarily in Canada. So there's not as much of a need. So One Soccer is really filling a need in this country, and for it to be just like prioritizing soccer as a soccer fan myself is phenomenal. And as you've seen sort of the quality of the broadcast and the quality of the work they do, they're really going for it. And it's really, really nice to see.
Yeah. And especially coming into a year like this where, you know, the women most likely in the Olympics, you mm-hmm. know, the launch of the Canadian men's league, which I've had to explain to a lot of people. they're like, is it different the way that Canadian football is different? I'm like, no, yeah,
it's the same.
Soccer. It's all good.
All you know, people
and
rolled,
just that there's, yeah. And that there's so much more ways to watch soccer. Like I noticed mm-hmm. on the channel that they even had the women's league from Spain. They're not live broadcast, yeah. but they're on there. Like that's yeah, awesome.
Great. For sure.
Yeah.
So hopefully they get more.
So one last question for you. Yeah. One last question for you, Laura. What happens for Christine Sinclair after 2020 Olympics? Does she ride off into the sunset? Couple more seasons in Portland? Does she launch her own NWSL club in Vancouver or Burnaby rather? Where, you know, what do you think?
Well, I don't think she's launching a club anytime soon. Although I know that she thinks that it's very important to have professional women's teams and also a league in this country. But I think it would be really hard for her to leave Portland, even if she was headlining a team in, say, Vancouver, because I think that she considers them both home. She was asked that once at a press conference, and she definitely hesitated over it. So it'd be interesting to see. I think she keeps playing. I could see her playing till she's 40. I think she could, you know, definitely maybe even take like a reduced role or a player coach role if that's something that's of interest to her. Maybe you're not going to see her starting anymore, but I think that over the course of her career, she's become much more of a leader, and she's really interested in sort of helping to develop the talent that comes behind her. And I also know that she's very, very keen on having an all women's coaching staff for the Canadian soccer team. So it'll be interesting to see what she does. I don't think she's hanging up her boots anytime soon. I also don't think that she'll like quit internationally if she's still playing in the NWSL. I think that when her time comes, her time will come for everything. I can't see her doing both. But I still think that she still has like a good 4 years in her as long as she can stay healthy.
Yeah. And that's great to hear. And especially for Portland. Yeah. I mean, to me, Portland is Christine Sinclair.
Yeah, for sure. A lot
you know,
of
I know a lot of U.S. fans.
Canada,
a lot of U.S. fans,
Portland.
Yeah, are just like Heath, her aunt. You know, it's like, but like original yeah. player, right?
Yeah, she's the OG
scored
for
Portland's
sure.
Portland's first ever goal, like yeah. So
yeah, she bleeds Portland
and
for sure.
There are so few players from the original season of NWSL that are still with their original club. So that's mm-hmm. it's like I think it's like five players now. So it's like that's just so cool to see.
Yeah.
Well, Laura,
sure.
thanks so much for taking the time to, you know, talk all Canada soccer with me. Always appreciate it, and have fun with your last few broadcasts for the CONCACAF tournament.
Thank you so much for having me and for watching.
time for a little gensplaining. Today's topic, why do only 12 teams qualify for the Olympics? And why are the Olympics just a little different than the Women's World Cup? So several things to keep in mind in terms of Olympic soccer. One, Olympics, obviously not a women's soccer only event and not even a soccer only event. So huge, huge event, more than 10,000 athletes usually each Summer Olympics. So due to having a huge number of events around one city instead of being generally spread out through one country like the World Cup, the IOC, otherwise known as the International Olympic Committee, keeps the number of teams, sports, and roster sizes pretty small. So at this time, there's just 18 players per team going to the Olympics. You know, when the tournament started in 1996 for women, there were only 16 players. Additionally, FIFA doesn't want any event to have more importance or financial value, seriously, than the World Cup tournaments. So that's a big reason why the men's Olympic soccer tournament transitioned from a senior international tournament to a U23 tourney in the 1990s. Though the Olympic men's tournament, they do allow up to 3 overage players per roster. And down the line, I would not be surprised to see the same thing happen for the women. As more pro leagues start, we start to see more club competitions, hopefully down the line, a FIFA Club World Cup for women, a CONCACAF Champions League, and seeing more continental tournaments become better developed. Much like the Women's Euro already is, seeing that same thing for Asia, South America, CONCACAF. And here's another thing to keep in mind for the Olympics. There's a smaller window for the event in general. The Olympics is a 3-week event. So because of that, the games are played every 3 days. That's a pretty grueling schedule when you factor in travel between games and a smaller roster. They already start the soccer part of the Olympics before the opening ceremonies even begin. Obviously, the IOC, they're not going to stretch the Olympics anymore than they already have. So maybe down the line we will see 16 teams instead of 12, because that won't change your calendar, but you could not add another round without making the whole thing bigger. And one last thing, there is no bonus money directly associated with any Olympic event. Unlike the World Cup, where FIFA writes a big check to the teams that qualify and even bigger checks to the teams that win, there's no money coming from the IOC to any gold, silver, or bronze medalist. So any bonus money that the U.S. women receive for their performance this summer in Tokyo is coming completely from U.S. soccer. All right. Hope that's enlightening. If you ever have something you want me to answer in the Gensplainer, just send an email to keeper@keepernotes.com. All right, Jen Cooper, the Keeper, here with Stephanie Cleaves, the new executive director of United Women's Soccer, UWS, a relatively new women's league in the U.S. Stephanie, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So last month it was announced, I got this press release saying, hey, Stephanie Cleaves is now executive director United Women's Soccer. I did a little Googling. I'm like, ooh, I want to talk to this person. And of course, I've been paying attention to UWS for a while. But I bet most of my listeners don't know a lot about the league. So first, give us a little background of what this league is.
We're a national pro-am women's soccer league, featuring teams in Canada and the U.S. And our season takes place in the summer, from May through July, ending in a national championship.
And when you say pro-am, to me that means pro-amateur, which means college players can play in it without their eligibility being affected, right?
That's correct. And also, a lot of the teams have former college players and aspiring professionals. And we really exist to fill that gap between college and professional soccer.
And we've seen more players with UWS experience slowly getting into NWSL or being drafted or even going over to Europe and sign contracts, right?
That's correct. We had a number of NWSL draftee picks this season, as well as over 100 and I think the number is now 135 international professional contracts signed.
Wow, that's
over the past year, just over the past year. So in the off season, so it's really exciting.
And so what is your scope? What is the scope of your role as executive director? And what are your primary goals for the 2020 season?
To work with the league in promoting and the branding of the league, team retention, as well as trying to get quality teams to join our league, is basically to spread the word, the good news about our league and the organizations that are involved.
So you played soccer at three different universities. So how does that varied experience, how did that shape you as a player and then eventually as a coach and now a league administrator? I mean, all of these players in UWS, the bulk of them, you know, are playing in the U.S. college system. So talk about your experience and how it affects, you know, what you do now.
So I had a pretty serious injury that required surgery, like my senior year of high school. And, you know, I think a lot of college players end up facing that at some point, unfortunately. But instead of like being driven to improve and bounce back, I just never really, I don't feel like I ever really fully bounced back from it during my college career. So what I learned from that is there's a fine line with being content and being complacent. I kind of settled with the role I had on the team, and you shouldn't really settle with mediocrity. This is something I try to instill in my players that I coach, specifically college players, like just that, you know, don't be content, you know, don't be complacent, don't be okay with 5 minutes, but have a good attitude and give everything you have, work your ass off, and don't let that be a distraction. Don't let the obstacles get in your way of your goal. That's a huge lesson I learned during my college career. And how that like translates my position as a league administrator. I mean, there are obstacles in our way, but I'm not letting that distract or discourage me. I'm just focusing on the goal, and I'm really passionate about what we stand for.
And I think that must be great for some of the players to see that, okay, the figurehead of this league, the person, you know, the executive director is someone who, well, she played, you know, and, you know, she wasn't a high profile player. So she knows what we're going through. And you even spent a few years representing Honduras at the senior international level. And, you know, here's a CONCACAF team that we've never seen in the final round of either World Cup qualifying or Olympic qualifying. So talk about that experience and how it maybe helps you relate to the international players who spend their summers with UWS clubs.
Yeah, I actually think it was kind of funny. After I graduated college, I excelled more in soccer beyond college, you know, joining UWS, then getting the opportunity with Honduras. It was like a second chance, and I think that's something our league offers to players. My experience in Honduras, culturally, it was a little difficult to witness how far behind it is in Central America when it comes to respecting women's soccer. And obviously, we still have a ways to go in the U.S., but I really noticed the drive of certain foreign players and when they come over here. And I can empathize with the struggles they may face in their own country just to play soccer. Because in a lot of those countries, it's a man's game. And the women have to overcome a lot of prejudice in order to just play the game they love.
Yeah, I explain to people sometimes where they're like, you know, what is it, you know, like in other countries, you know, for women compared to what it is here to play soccer. And I was like, it's as if, you know, women here were trying to play NFL, right? Because soccer in many other countries, it is the dominant sport. So, you know, imagine the pushback of, you know, women trying to play American football, you know, on the same level as men. And since you graduated from college, it looks like you've had two parallel career paths, you know, digital marketing, design, but also coaching. So which one are you more passionate about, or would you say it's a draw?
That's really tough because I'm passionate about both, but I'm really passionate about digital marketing and branding within the soccer world, and, you know, staying involved and coaching girls and women helps to remind me why I'm so passionate about my role within UWS.
And then, you know, how do you put those two areas of expertise together? You know, how can they benefit your role as executive director?
Well, I can see that there's a need for our league. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a need to provide role models for all these girls that play soccer. And there's also a need for the players to have a professional outlet on their pathway to pro. And so kind of combining my expertise in branding and marketing, it really motivates me to do the best I can to promote our league and give the opportunity to the players.
And is the logo that the league is using right now, is that the one you designed?
Yeah, that was, so back in 2015, when the league formed, I was playing with a pro-am. Well, I was playing with a team of one of the founders, and they were looking for a logo designer for the league. So I just jumped on that opportunity.
Sweet. And of course, being, you know, a fellow graphic designer, I love that, you know, now you're in the executive director role. So, you know, do you think maybe we'll see some Stephanie Cleaves designed merch for sale, you know, for UWS?
Yeah, we've had a request for that. I think, you know, the players really like the brand and our social media presence. And they have asked, you know, when are you guys getting stuff printed? So we are working on some different options to provide our fans and players.
And if you know, someone wants to follow UWS, support UWS, what are the best ways that they can do that?
Well, we are on all the most popular social media platforms, except for Snapchat. We're on Instagram.
Is that Twitter, does that count Facebook. As popular anymore?
It's very popular among the young people. So, yeah, we're at UWS Soccer. That's our handle. So we're on LinkedIn, nice. Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
And can people watch games remotely, or is that something that'll come in a few seasons, or at least is the championship streamed? I mean, I haven't looked into that. So what are the options there?
Yeah, it's actually a requirement for each team in our league to live stream. And we use the platform MyCujo. That's MyCoojo. Oh man, I'm probably misspelling. they're a partner of the league. So all of the games are up there, and that's something that, you know, we're asking of the teams to provide professional standards for the players and give them more exposure.
And that's huge, just to exposure of the league itself, right? That if you hear of this league and you're like, oh, I didn't know about that league, to be able to say, yeah, you can watch the games for free on my Cujo, that's huge, yeah. Right? As opposed to, yeah, they play, but you can't watch it. You know, I mean, I think one of the best things that NWSL ever did its first season was be like, hey, we're putting all the games up on YouTube. Of course, I think it took Boston a year to take their paywall down on theirs. But it's like, that's great, right? And they're still all archived up there, which I love. So that's really great to hear. And I'm sure you've got some expansion coming up for this year, right? It seems like that there's more UWS teams each season.
Yeah, and you know, our goal is to attract teams that share our vision for the league, and we're really fortunate just to have the organizations involved that we have. They're super passionate about the women's game, investing in women's soccer, and just providing the best possible experience for their players and fans.
Well, Stephanie, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today, and good luck with your first season as executive director.
Thank you.
All right, time to wrap it up with the back four. If you haven't already heard, the newest edition of the Keeper Notes NWSL Almanac is now available for purchase. The 350-page comprehensive guide to the NWSL's first 7 seasons features a complete player registry, coach registry, stats by season, overall stat leaders, color photos, lots of fun lists, lots more. You cannot get all of this information in one place anywhere else. Order now at keepernotes.com. You can get print version, PDF version, or both. And there's also a link so you can see a sneak preview of some of the pages within the almanac. And of course, we're almost done with Olympic qualifying. Semifinals are this Friday, February 7th in Southern California. First semi is Canada versus Costa Rica at 6 p.m. Central on Fox Soccer Plus, and then USA versus Mexico at 9 p.m. Central on Fox Sports 1. If you can't access either of those channels, I would highly recommend the new One Soccer app that Laura Armstrong and I discussed earlier in this episode. It does offer a one-day pass for just a few dollars, and so far has not been geo-blocked. I kid you not, I've been able to watch this Canada app in the U.S. Please don't tell them. And winners of the semifinals for this tournament, they qualify directly for the Olympics, and then, of course, they get to play in the final on Sunday at 5 p.m. Central. Keep in mind, only 2 teams qualify from CONCACAF for the Olympics, so there is no third-place game in this tournament. And looking past Olympic qualifying, the next set of games for the U.S. women, it's going to be the annual She Believes tournament. This will be the 5th edition of the tournament, and this year they'll face England on March 5th in Orlando, then Spain making their She Believes debut. That'll be March 8th at Red Bull Arena in Harrison, New Jersey. And then March 11th, they'll wrap things up against Japan in Frisco, Texas, north of Dallas. Tickets are already on sale at ussoccer.com. And while you're on that website, I would check out the sale. They're having a Valentine's Day sale on 4-star merch. Also, they've unveiled the new 2020 USA jerseys, both home and away. And last, mark your calendars. April 18th is the start of the NWSL regular season. We should have the schedule out, and I'd say week to 2 weeks at the latest. All teams already have their season tickets on sale, so you can go to NWSLsoccer.com now, click on the ticket menu, and find the page for your favorite team. And if you're not in an NWSL city, consider buying a half-season package or a few tickets for the game, for the team you follow the most, and then donate those tickets back to the club so they can give them to someone who couldn't otherwise afford to go. That way you're supporting the team and you're putting butts in seats. Just a thought. And of course, thanks to our sponsor, Roughneck Scarves, official scarf supplier to MLS, USL, and US Soccer. Get custom scarves for your group or team at roughneckscarves.com. And that is R-U-F-F-N-E-C-K scarves. And tired of those same old uniforms, cookie cutter templates from Nike and Adidas? Don't get me started on those. Looking for a completely custom kit for your club, Sunday squad, adult, or even pro team? Check out Icarus FC. They can help you create the kit of your dreams at an affordable price. Just go to IcarusFC.com. And for those of you who can't spell, I-C-A-R-U-S-F-C.com. All right, that's it for this episode, including ads. I'm so excited to actually have some ads in this podcast. Many thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks to anyone who recommends this podcast to someone else. And many, many thanks to Sean and Beautiful Game Network for making this podcast possible. But now she's anybody's girl.